Okay, so I want to talk today about some general problems that we've been thinking about for the last 10 or 20 years, but in the last couple of years, there's been some new ideas that have come out, and I think they enable us to take a fresh whack at them, and indeed I'll describe such a whack today. So the circle of ideas that I want to talk about, or really the circles of ideas that I want to connect, are first of all 2A Calabi-Yau black hole. Wouldn't have to be Calabi-Yau, but basically black hole attractors. And so this would be in D equals 4. And so this is the near horizon geometry of a BPS black hole carrying some set of charges in four dimensions. There should be some kind of via adiat, since there's a near horizon region which has an ADS2 factor. We expect that there should be some kind of ADS2 CFT1 duality, and so this should be dual to some kind of one-dimensional conformal quantum mechanics. And it's certainly interesting that ADS CFT has been around for quite a while now, and you might think that the lower you go in dimension, the simpler it gets. But in fact, this potentially most simplest of all examples is still quite elusive. So we'd like to understand that. On the other hand, another interesting connected topic is so-called quiver gauge theories. Or really what we'd be interested in this case would be the one-dimensional version, which would be quiver gauge quantum mechanics. And indeed, if we have a black hole, a 2A black hole and a Calabi-Yau, we can associate with that, carry some set of charges. We can think of those charges as emanating from some set of brains. On each collection of brains, we have some kind of gauge theory, and then there are the strings running between them. So for every black hole attractor, we can write down an associated quiver gauge theory, though we're not too clear exactly what the association is. But we'd like to think that that this quiver quantum mechanics is somehow related to the conformal quantum mechanics by some kind of renormalization group flow. So this is the circle of ideas that we'd like to flesh out and make precise. And that's what I've embarked on with... the ultimate goal would be to write down for every 2A Calabi-Yau black hole attractor, write down some kind of dual one-dimensional conformal quantum mechanics that is large and dual in the usual ADS-CFT sense. So I've been working with a bunch of collaborators. I better write their names down. There's Davide Gaiotto, who's a postdoc at Harvard, Monica Guica, student at Harvard, Shi Yin, student at Harvard, Aaron Simons, student at Harvard, and Lisa Huang, also a student at Harvard. So what we did in, my talk will bear on a number of our different papers, but what we did in most recent work called D4, D0 Brains on the Quintic, was try to understand the general problem of the attractor geometry in the quintic associated with n d4 brains and m d0 brains. In other words, there's some kind of there's a black hole in the 2A theory on the quintic. There's just one topologically non-trivial 4-cycle. We can wrap N4 brains on there, and that gives us some black hole of charge N, but we can also stick MD0 brains on that, and that gives some kind of black hole with these two charges that has a near horizon geometry, and we'd like to understand what the dual of that is. And so that led us to study the problem of D4 brains and D0 brains on the quintic. And there has been a lot of work on D brains on Calabi-Yau's. Mike Douglas was one of the pioneers of this subject. Greg Moore, Frederick Deneff did some recent beautiful work. Rommelsberger, Aspinwall. So so there has been a lot of work on the general subject of D brains and Calabi-Yau, but my emphasis is going to be a little bit different. Many of these works were concerned with finding exact boundary states for D brains and Calabi-Yau spaces, which can be done for some cases at Gepner points or in non-compact Calabi-Yau's. And most of the models which were studied in detail were not rich enough to actually be duals to some kind of macroscopic geometry. And the D4, D0 system seems to be the one of the simplest things that we could study. It was the simplest thing. Do you want to say something, Mike?
Series of lectures by Hanani talking about the dualities between large class of these theories and ADS, CFT. So statement seems a little inconfined.
Okay, I missed the long lecture series, sorry. So we just wanted to study this very simple system. So how should we describe this simple system? Well, let's start out, and it turns out that we can start out to describe it, and it's not very long until we run into a paradox. And what I'm going to do mostly in this talk is describe the paradox that we run into and how it's resolved. So let's start out just with D4 brains. Okay, so we have a Calabi-Yau, and let's start out, in fact, with one D4 brain. And to be explicit, let's take the quintic. So we have the sum of A equals 1 to 5 of Z A to the 5th is equal to 0. And then let's take one D4 brain, which we can... The simplest sort of generating D4 brain, we can describe by an equation like phi A, Z A equals 0. This is called the hyperplane section. It's just the simplest 4-cycle, holomorphic 4-cycle that we can have in this geometry. And notice that, of course, this equation... So I start out with a 3-complex dimensional manifold. I have one complex equation, so now I'm down to 2-complex dimension. But notice that the surface doesn't change under phi A goes to lambda phi A. So we can think of phi A as living on P4. So the moduli space of a single D4 brain on the quintic is topologically P4, But of course, we don't know what the actual metric on that space is. In principle, at large volume, we could compute the metric, but it would basically be induced. The expression wouldn't be very enlightening because it would be some kind of induced metric from the metric on the Calabi-Yau, and we don't know what that is anyway, so what good would it do us to get a metric on this space in terms of some other metric that we don't know? Now, what I'm going to do in this talk is I'm not going to try to overcome that problem that we don't know explicit forms of the metric. I'm just going to really consider the topological aspects of the theory, the complex structure on the various moduli spaces, and so on. Sort of in the spirit of the construction of Landau-Ginzburg models in conformal field theory. Okay. So this lives on P4. So there are four deformations of this surface. And so the theory describing the D-brain should be given by, so one D4 brain should be given by just a U1 gauge theory. And plus four chiral multiplets, the phi A's. Okay, now what happens if we take N four brains and wrap them on here? So if we take N four brains and wrap them on there, if the four brains aren't exactly on top of each other, then we would get, of course, or if we pull them apart in the non-compact R3, we would have to have N U1 gauge theories and 4N chiral multiplets. And what happens if we put them all on top of each other? Well, if we put them all on top of each other, what we expect is that we get a UN gauge theory. And phi A gets promoted to an N by N matrix in the adjoint of UN. So at this point, this is kind of a guess, because this is a complicated system. But we'll see that we'll give evidence that this guess is correct. Okay. So now we've got. So now we've got these ND4 brains all sitting right on top of each other on this minimal cycle. But now we can, in the quintic, we can have a generic degree N cycle. Which is described by a polynomial, you know, z1 to the n plus, you know, some lambda 1 z1 to the n plus lambda 2 z1 to the n minus 17 z2 to the 16 z3 and so on. There's a lot of all equal to 0. And at special points, this equation will degenerate and describe for special values of this coefficient, this equation will degenerate. In fact, we can write down what it could degenerate to phi a z a to the n equals 0. That's also a degree n equation. So at special point, I'll degenerate to that, and it will describe the system that we were talking about here. So what we would expect is that, well, how many such equations are there? Or what's the dimension of the space of degree n surfaces? Well, there are two ways to derive that. One is to, there's an index theorem, and you can start with the, you take the Chern class of the quintic, which is 1 plus j to the fifth over 1 plus 5j, and then take 1 plus nj, and the number of deformations of the surface is a characteristic class integrated over this degree n surface using this the Chern class here. And if you do that, you find that the dimension of the moduli space is I think 5n cubed to leading order in n. Another way to do it is you can just count the number of independent equations. So it's not all possible coefficients here, because for example, if I take the quintic itself and multiply it by something of degree n minus 5, that won't change the hypersurface. There are lots of things that don't change the hypersurface. And when you take that all into account, you find that the dimension of the moduli space is of order 5n cubed. And another thing about this moduli space, so the dimension is 5n cubed, and it has a complex structure which depends on the complex structure of the quintic itself. And so this space, essentially, we're quotienting by the quintic equation, and if we change that equation, we change what this space is. So these two facts are going to get us into trouble in a minute, and let me explain why. So what we'd like to think, if we've guessed right here, is that this theory here in the unbroken phase where we have a UN gauge symmetry describes n d-branes on top of each other, but this obviously has a moduli space and a Higgs branch, and we'd like to think that the generic degree n surface in the quintic is described by basically the moduli space of the generic degree n surface is the moduli space of the Higgs branch of a UN gauge theory with four chiral multiplets in the adjoint. That's what we'd like to have happen. But there's two problems with that. The first problem is that the dimension of this moduli space is 5n cubed. And over here, we've only got of order n squared fields. And there's no way that if you start out with n squared fields and you satisfy the W flatness and the F flatness and the D flatness conditions that you're going to get something of order n cubed. So that puzzled us for a long time. We thought maybe this wasn't all the fields. Maybe there was somehow at the self-intersection point there were sort of n cubed fields floating around. We tried all kinds of things, but it turns out if you just are very careful and it all works itself out in a nice way, as we'll see. But let me also mention what the second puzzle is. The second puzzle is that there's no room to put a superpotential over here. If you put a superpotential, you would restrict the motion of these D4 brains in such a way that you couldn't, for example, freely separate them. So it would not agree with things we knew to be true if we were to add a superpotential over here. On the other hand, there are four supercharges. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, there's a very general and beautiful statement that is made in a number of different places, that in these D-brain theories, we expect that the gauge theory describing the D-brain should have the property that the complex structure, this is for 2A D-brains, the complex structure can appear only in the superpotential, and the Kähler class can only appear in only the D terms. And here we've got a moduli space which depends on the complex structure of the quintic. So there's no way on earth that we could ever get that moduli space as from some kind of D-flatness condition which tells you what the moduli space is of the Higgs branch of this theory. Okay. So in order to resolve this, we have to be more careful. And the thing we have to be more careful about is exactly what charges, not just D4 brain charge, but there are other charges floating around here, D2 brain charge and D0 brain charge, that are induced in various ways. And we have to be careful about charge conservation. So how does this work? Well, the first thing is, it turns out that this simplest cycle here is not a spin manifold. And therefore, since it's not a spin manifold, see, in general, we might have a two-form world volume field strength non-zero on this four cycle. Now, originally, we were hoping to just set that to zero and not think about it. But according to Greg and others, that we're not allowed to do that here because the K-theory police will be after us, because in general, if you don't have a spin manifold, F has to be in half integral cohomology plus some element of integral cohomology. And in this particular example, we need to have F is equal to a half J, where J is basically the pullback of the fundamental form on the CP4 in which the Calabi-Yau is. There's only one cohomology class on the Calabi-Yau, and that pulls back onto this cycle. And we have to have F equal to half J. Yeah?
You have to have that in order to have a spin C structure or something like that? So
you have to have that to keep the K-theory police off your back. I don't know. I looked it up in Greg's paper. I don't, string theory is not consistent without this F equals a half J. It's not a short story, I don't think. You want 15 seconds to explain it, Greg? No. Okay. I think it's not a short story. Okay? So you have to have F equals a half J. Now, the membrane charge of this system is is equal to F wedge J, the integral over the integral over this 4-cycle of F wedge J. Now, that works out to be, if we take F equals to a half J, that works out to be 5/2. And in addition, the zero brain charge is equal to minus the integral over this cycle, which I'm calling P1, and the 1 is for degree 1. It's a four-dimensional cycle, but the 1 stands for degree 1, is equal to, I think it's a half F squared plus 1/24 the second Chern class of the tangent bundle of this cycle. And that works out to be, let me give the general answer for degree n. Calling this thing k, that's equal to k minus 5n cubed plus 50n over 24. And so for F equal to a half J in this system, this Q is 0 is equal to minus 15 over 4. Okay, so we have two brain charge and we have zero brain charge. And so if we combine two of these cycles, we're going to get we have to conserve charge. And you can see that if we were to imagine that F could always be zero, we'd run into a contradiction. Because if we took n cycles with F equals zero and combine them together and get a degree n cycle with F equal to zero, we'd have some zero brain charge, which is of order n cubed. So obviously, there's no way of combining n elementary D4 brains and getting one big degree n D4 brain which doesn't somehow have a world volume gauge field excited. So we're always going to have a world volume gauge field excited. But that's not going to be enough. That would be okay if we only needed to conserve, say, D2 brain charge. But we need to conserve both D2 brain charge and D0 brain charge. And so we've got two equations and one parameter. It's, in general, we can't solve it. And it's easy to see that you already can't solve it if you just take two D4 brains and join them together into a third one. So what do you have to do? Well, this F is constrained by supersymmetry. And the statement is that F, so supersymmetry, implies that F is equal to an anti-self-dual form plus n plus a half times the pullback of J. That's the constraint of supersymmetry. And so basically, this anti-self-dual form is something which is of type 1, 1. Now, actually, Greg and I and Manasian wrote a paper in which we found that these equations were deformed a little bit, but I don't think that's relevant for any integer. This is just the constraint of supersymmetry. Okay. All right. So, okay. So what happens now? Well, let's try combining just three of these guys. If we try to combine three of these guys, we have to conserve charge. So if we combine three, we need to have Q0 is equal to 3 times 5 halves, which is 15 halves, and Q2 should be equal to minus 35 over 4. Did I get these right? Okay. Sorry, this one I think is wrong. I think this one is minus 35 over 12. Let me just look in my paper. Yeah, it's minus 35 over 12. I don't know where I got that from. Okay. It's minus 35. No, and I want to exchange them. This is Q2 and this is Q0. Now, it won't take you very long to convince yourselves from these formula that there's no way to choose J in order to that can solve this. There's no way to choose. There's no choice of F proportional to J that will give me a 3-cycle with these membrane, 2-brain and 0-brain charges. So what I need is that I need to be able to set the D0 brain charge and the D2 brain charge independently. So what I need is some other 1-1 class on my D4 brain, which doesn't induce any D2 brain charge. In other words, it's an F minus, which is orthogonal to J. So I need to be able to add an F minus, which is orthogonal to J, and in that way I can adjust the D0 brain charge without shifting the D2 brain charge. Now, but of course, I didn't even say this, but maybe it was obvious, this of course is a U1 gauge field, so it has to be an integral cohomology. Now, in general, these 4-cycles have lots of elements of H2. There are lots of non-trivial 2-cycles within these 4-cycles. But as we change this equation around, the complex structure changes on the 4-cycles, and which are type 1-1 and which are type 0-2 varies continuously. And generically, there will be no integral 1-1 forms. So generically, anything which is type 1-1 will not be integral, so you can't turn this on. Another way of saying this is, if you have an integral 1-1 form, it's dual to a divisor, and you can find you can rephrase this problem mathematically as the problem of finding some 2-cycle or finding a curve which is embedded wholly within this hypersurface. And obviously, if we find a curve wholly embedded within this hypersurface and then we move this hypersurface in a generic way, it's not going to stay in there anymore. Okay, so we solved this mathematical problem of finding when you could embed the hypersurface when you had these extra integral 1-1 forms. And the answer is that it's true for degree n equations, which can be written in the form determinant phi a z. In this case, it would be degree 3, but this generalized to degree n. If I can write the equation in this form, where phi A is equal to an n by n matrix, then if I can write the equation in this form, then I can always construct, actually using the minors of this determinant, we actually explicitly constructed this this curve here, which sits inside the hypersurface.
So if your hypersurface is of this form, then there exists an orthogonal one-one in the one-one class.
That's the statement, and we explicitly constructed it.
And it's one would solve your trig problem.
What?
If one would solve the problem of a new trig.
Yeah.
There are lots of curves.
Well, I mean, I think basically anyone has a good solving that. Once you've got this, it's not very hard to solve the charge problem, right? It will solve the charge problem. We worked out exactly how to solve the charge problem. You're worried if its degree was too high or something that we couldn't.
Yeah, I'm worried more about the fact that there are lots of other ways of solving this problem. This is a way of solving the problem. So either this is the unique way to solve the problem that also solves the problem that you started with. Just the problem of finding a curve.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are lots of other possible choices to consider.
Okay, I don't know about the other ways to solve this problem. I'd like to hear about them. Okay, so phi is an n by n matrix, and now. The moduli space of these curves that have these special divisors, so now we've killed two birds with one stone. Because the moduli space of these curves that have this special divisor is of order n squared. Right? It's just the coefficients, you know, the terms in each of these each component of this n by n matrix. They can be arbitrary numbers. Then they're of order n squared of those. What's also interesting is that this space doesn't depend on the complex structure of the quintic itself. Kind of surprising. You know, you've got this, you know, the moduli space of hypersurfaces in the quintic with no restriction depends very much on what particular quintic we choose, but if we ask for the moduli space of things which just which have these special divisors, which we need in order to satisfy charge conservation, then that doesn't care about the complex structure of the quintic. Okay, so we killed two birds with one stone. We can now count in two different ways. So now the conjecture that the moduli space of curves with special divisor can be identified with the Higgs branch of this gauge theory is alive again. But now we can actually count the dimension in two different ways, and we can count the dimension here. What do we do? Well, we take into account the fact that this is not modified by, the surface is not changed if we multiply on the right or left by GLN, and we also have to take into account the D-term constraints, and over here we have to count the dimension of the Higgs branch. We start with some number of fields. The D-term constraint is the language appropriate over here. We start with some number of fields. We worry about the D-term constraints and the gauge symmetry, and some things some fields are lost due to the Goldstone mechanism. And in both cases, we find that the dimension is, I think, 3n squared. The complex dimension is, I think, 3n squared plus 1. Yeah, I think it's 3n squared plus 1. Anyway, we get exactly the same number, which I think is 3n squared plus 1. Okay. So we can match the dimension of the moduli space, but we can even go a little further than that, and we can actually see this equation coming out of the gauge theory. And the way we see this equation coming out of the gauge theory is by adding, so far we've just had D4 brains. The way we see the equation coming out of the gauge theory is by adding a test D0 brain and looking at the moduli space of that D0 brain, and we find that the moduli space of that D0 brain is given by this equation here. So let me explain how that goes. So if we add a D0 brain, now we have a superpotential. So the superpotential looks like, so we have our n D4s here, and we have a D0 brain, and then we have, so now we have the 4-4 strings, which I'll call phi A. We have the D0 brain, which has, the part that I'm interested in is the three chiral multiplets describing the motion of the D0 brain. Now, so we have phi A Z A, and then we have 0-4 strings. It turns out if you do the counting, they're both 0-4 and 4-0 strings, which are independent. And so we have a superpotential W, which is basically trace. I should write it as phi 0-4, phi A, no trace, sorry, phi A, phi 4-0, ZA. And this superpotential can be derived by taking this, the fact that this has to be there can be derived by considering, obviously it's allowed by the symmetries, it's the simplest thing allowed by the symmetries, and to see that it has to be there with a non-zero coefficient, you can just look at various special limits. In addition, because we have D2 brain charge, we know that there has to be a phi Eliopoulos term and associated D potential, which looks like 540 squared minus 504 squared minus zeta, where zeta is proportional to the D2 brain charge. Another way of understanding why that phi Eliopoulos term has to be there is that in this example, we expect the D0 brain to actually be attracted to the D4 brain because there's some D2 brain charge in there. This is all squared. So in order to solve this, we give phi 4-0 of F. They would be cubic. They become cubic because we can't expand these around. The phi A and Z A are both kind of coordinates on P4. Yeah. And they become cubic in the expansion about that. And I really should have another term here involving the quintic equation, which would force the Z to lie on the Calabi-Yau hypersurface in the quintic. Okay. So, but this reduces, when you take that into account, that this reduces to like the kind of thing that Callan and Maldacena wrote when they studied intersecting four brains, which, okay. So, 5.40 has to be equal to zeta. And now, Zeta times, sorry. Zeta times, it's 540 has n components, so it's zeta times some vector v, where v squared is 1. And now if we look at the equation for the superpotential for supersymmetry, dw d phi 04 equals 0, we see that phi a za must have a 0 eigenvalue. So again, we see, which is equivalent to the equation that we wrote over here, determinant phi a za equals 0. So this simple guess here seems to really have captured a lot of the geometry of and has given a very, you know, precise correspondence between geometry of the geometry of Calabi-Yau hypersurfaces and the gauge theory in an exactly the way that we would hope to happen. So in the remaining 10 minutes, maybe I should pause and see if there are any questions. Yeah. You mean from the non-abelian things? I mean, you have to take that into account, and yes, it is a constraint. And you need to take that constraint into account, and in order for this to match. Generally, what happens is that these things go in partners, right? So you have a gauge symmetry. So if you think about the SUN D terms, right, you have an SUN gauge symmetry, which removes n squared minus 1 fields. But everything is always complex. So the D term constraint goes along, typically the D term constraint goes along with the gauge symmetry to remove one complex field. It turns that real n squared minus 1 to a complex n squared minus 1. Okay, so so far this is giving us confidence that this simple guess is capturing a lot of the physics of this problem. Now, we'd also like to know what happens if we say now add a large macroscopic number of D0 brains. So now here we just had one D0 brain. And since I only have 10 minutes, I'm going to go through this quickly. But that's OK, because this was the really sort of meaty precise part of the computation. So we have M D0 brains. We can write down the moduli space of the Higgs branch, and all M D0 brains are bound to this surface and to the four cycle. We can see that from the D and F flatness conditions. They can bind to each other in the usual way. So as usual, the moduli space becomes the Hilbert scheme of M copies of this guy, and the cohomology of that gives us back correctly the leading term of the black hole entropy. Now, this is not a new calculation of the black hole entropy. This calculation is isomorphic mathematically to a calculation that Maldacena and Witten and I did in 98 or something like that. But it's significant in this context in that it tells us that this system with the UN cross UM gauge theory is rich enough that it really ought to provide the dual of a macroscopic geometry. In other words, so what we would like to do now, you know, having persuaded ourselves with these various tests that this model is at least that this quiver gauge theory is on the right track, we'd like to go and understand the circle that I erased. In other words, what is the duality? How, in what sense is this this quiver gauge theory dual to two-way string theory on the attractor geometry? And we already got a long way. We already showed that it had the right number of microstates, but we'd like to see more. So one of the things that we're doing now, which again we've made some progress on, is yes.
So far you focus on the forebrain. So this is like a 4+1 gauge theory.
No, it was a quantum mechanics. The forebrain was wrapping a cycle. The forebrain was wrapping a cycle in the Calabi-Yau. And so it was just a U1 gauge quantum mechanics. I was just keeping the light modes of the forebrain in the reduction to the 3+1 non-compact dimensions. Yeah, that's a confusing point. I probably wasn't emphasizing it enough.
It really suffices to get the BPS state counting, but now for a full dual theory, I guess you might wonder if keeping only the light degrees of freedom suffices.
Right. You mean non-BPS stuff?
Yeah.
So since, well,
that's right.
So I can understand that the adjoint, you know, the normal bundle scalars for fluctuations nearby the brain should live in a linear space, but eventually aren't they going to bump into the Calabi-Yau? Couldn't that make a difference between the moduli space of the brain and the moduli space of the gauge theory? See what I mean? Your adjoint scalars are living in some linear space. That's sort of like the, you know,
they're not really living in a linear space.
When you're, there's a more correct theory.
There's a more correct version of this, and which I didn't try to go through, but always drives all the cognoscenti crazy when I present it this way, and. It's like, let me just say briefly what it is. So how do you get from C5 to P4? The way you get from C5 to P4, you start out with 5 free scalar fields. You draw a quiver diagram like this, with one arrow, and you have a U1 here and a U1 here. And then you have a Phi Heliopolis term, and the moduli space of this thing, it starts out with S9, and then you rotate out by the okay. So now what we really should be doing here is have a UN and a UN and 5 scalar fields going like this. And then there is a linear model for that. And then each one of these lives on a any individual scalar field lives on a P4, so it's compact.
Well, they're all matrices in the original formulation.
Yeah,
when you solve the D-term constraints, it becomes compact.
Yeah,
but I mean, this is sort of a more physical description because this is the bound state of N D6 brains and the anti-D6 brains of brain fluxes. So it's actually an easier way to get your N2-4 targets.
Right. Okay, so so what we'd like to do now.
So on top of this, we also have all this super potentials and this other D terms, right? So, I mean, correct theory should include this plus what you just wrote here, this combination of this thing, right?
Right.
So, what is the complete control, like, super diagram?
Yeah, okay. So I should also say that this can be I didn't try to write down the general. The approach I've taken here is not to try to write down the general answer and to try to keep it the minimal things as possible by just describing one simple thing. You can write down a general quiver gauge theory for a general complete intersection toric variety, which is the candidate dual for actually, there's some problems with getting certain kinds of charges, but you can certainly do a lot. You can do it for a general complete intersection toric variety. We haven't so far understood how to get general charges for a general complete intersection toric variety, but we'll probably, my students will probably figure that out. Complete intersection, yeah.
I mean, just in the case of quintic, so
yeah.
I mean, I'm still following on this Greg question. So I just want to know the complete answer for the 4D0 primes in a quintic, taking into account this condition that the problem is nonlinear, they cannot go far. So they'll get into the middle.
Well, this is it for D4.
No, just because the moduli, even if the Taylor quotient gives you a compact moduli space, it's not obvious that it's the right.
Yeah, that's why I'm hesitant. No, I think it's obvious that it's not right in the sense that the kinetic term that you would get from this construction at large volume would not agree with the kinetic term.
But that's not the question. I mean, just you're trying to get this moduli space right.
Right. So we're not trying to get detailed forms of kinetic term.
Now you can actually prove in this case
that it's not right?
No, that it's right, that the moduli space is exactly described by this.
Described by what? So it's
the two. If you just have the D4s. No, it's really unsolved how to really add the D4s and the D0s all moving on the right compact moduli spaces. There is no concrete expression of that sort in the literature. That's right. I mean, this we got that we have, but the whole problem not yet.
Wait, which part are you worried about?
Well, to get the D4 moduli space and the D0 moduli space all as compact moduli spaces in the whole.
Yeah.
So, wait, Mike, what did you say was true? You said
the D4s. That describes ND4s.
That describes ND4s, which started out from the linear cycle.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that started out.
Right, but if we take and we add now MD0s.
But Andy, if you started out from a quadratic cycle instead of a linear cycle, you could try to solve that problem. So you could.
That would be a different gauge theory.
Right.
Quadratic,
it's not going to be a linear form.
Quadratic doesn't mean degree two.
It means degree two intersections with the quintic. So he's taking linear intersections with the quintic.
Right.
He argued successfully that n copies of that was not the general degree n intersection with the quintic, but it was the special space.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, There are lots of deep brain moduli spaces to study.
I don't know if we've done the completely general. I'm sure we haven't done the completely general thing.
Which, if I understand it right, sort of implies this is the answer to this problem. But maybe we should discuss exactly what that is. You know, I mean, this is the degree n thing in P4, and everything comes from restricting that to the.
Right.
Sorry, Mike. What's the theorem you just referred to?
Well, the simple thing, which is you know. I might even be able to prove is that this describes the moduli space of a degree n hypersurface in P4, which is a three-dimensional thing. And then the more non-trivial thing is that, in fact, all of these two-dimensional hypersurfaces in the quintic just come from the intersecting those three-dimensional things in P4 with the quintic. All the ones that satisfy the condition.
But it won't be the general hypersurface, right? It'll be
the condition that you want.
So before this, there was this kind of gross mismatch. It looked like everything was way off, you know, because we had an n cubed instead of n squared. And we thought people were talking about, you know, there were n cubed extra degrees of freedom, little strings, that there, you know. But I think it's clear that we don't need anything that, we don't need any of that, and that the actual story could be quite simple to state. And then when you work out the details, they can get complicated, but the starting point is simple. Now but the thing that we're trying to understand now is take this UN cross UM gauge theory, with D4 brains and D0 brains. And what I'd like to, what we'd like to see, let me draw the circle. You know, we had attractor geometries, quiver gauge theories, quiver quantum mechanics, and CFT1. What we'd like to see, in some aspects of which we have been able to see, is that if you take one D0 brain and treat it like a probe, and integrate out everything else, that the effective action for that D0 brain is that of a D0 brain in the 2A attractor geometry. There's one term in the action that we've successfully, a sort of protected term in the action that we've successfully computed. That so somehow this gas of D4 brains and D0 brains should look, should generate the Calabi-Yau geometry. That's the thing that we want to see. And even better, we'd like to see the conformal quantum mechanics. And indeed, there was a paper almost a year ago by Gaiauto In and myself in which we wrote down a conformal quantum mechanics which in which we took D0 brains in an attractor geometry and found these interesting bound states that there were just enough of to account for the black hole entropy. Now, that wasn't a completely satisfying answer to the question, what is the conformal quantum mechanics? Because we did, it was clear that that formulation already has some things integrated out, namely the D4 brains. So what we'd like to do is to, you know, try to understand those kinds of models and try to understand about how integrating out in a 1 over n approximation various the D4 brains, the other D4 brains than D0 brain, creates the attractor geometry. So I think I'll stop there.
So if you take the 4D black hole and you take it to 5 dimensions, you get a black stream, which will have a dual 2-dimensional CFT. And if you then reduce that, which we leave on a circle, if you reduce that to on the circle, do you get the same conformal quantum mechanics that you're constructing directly to?
Well, okay. I mean, it's sometimes true that if you take a 4D black hole and you lift it to 5D, that you get a black string. And indeed, you know, long ago, Maldacena and Witten and I, in a sense, had a duel for 4D black holes in which the conformal field theory, there's an SL2R symmetry in the conformal field theory, and that SL2R was the dual symmetry to the SL2R isometry of the near horizon ADS2. Now, but this doesn't work for every 4D black hole. And I don't think that it doesn't work for every black hole. You're in a funny regime of moduli space when you think of things this way. You're really lifting up to ADS3, and so I think that's kind of cheating. I think you're going into a limit where ADS2. I mean, it's not wrong, it's just not the interesting question. I think the interesting question, and I think it's interesting because we haven't been able to understand it, is to understand what ADS2 CFT1 is when we can't think of it as a limit of ADS3 CFT2. where we're in some regime of moduli space where that's just not the right way to think about it. But maybe that, you know, that could be wrong. It could be that ADS2 CFT1 doesn't have a life of its own, and it's only some limit. It's always some limit of ADS3 CFT2. But yeah.
Just to get the direction. So if we took this four brain system, you would like to scale up N and put in a D0 and integrate out the UN parts and see that the D0 is moving around on this brain in this collodion.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a trick question because actually, if you scale up N in the way I just said, this black hole is not stable, it decays into two objects.
Well, then you were scaling up N in the wrong way. I mean, there is some way.
I'm saying there are other problems. I'm not saying there aren't other problems of that sort, but this one has that property.
Even with the D2 in there?
Well, if you take this one, if you add enough D2, you probably can fix it. But if you add the D2, which makes it described by this.
I mean, I thought the Phi Heliopolis term killed the Coulomb branch.
It's, you know,
there's no Coulomb branch.
It depends on, it's an order of limits, actually. It's even a trickier question. I'm just testing.
So you're telling me if you do the wrong thing?
If you take the volume of the collodion to infinity faster than N, then the thing stays stable. But if you don't do that.
I mean, the volume of the collodion is really a function of N and M by the attractor mechanism. So I'm not sure what you're saying. This quiver gauge theory doesn't have the volume of the collodion in it. It has N and M in it. And you know, the ranks, what we expect to see in this general correspondence is that the Kähler class of the collodion is related to the ranks of the various gauge groups and possibly Phi Heliopolis terms in the quiver gauge theory, and the complex structure of the collodion is determined by parameters in the superpotential of the quiver gauge theory.
Mike, in what you're thinking of, are you taking into account the attractor, that you're at the attractor collodion for those charges?
No, because there's another limit that you could take where the charge is small. That's right. So if you take the limit of the charge large, you might want to put the attractor.
We don't get to freely vary the parameters of the collodion. The collodion is coming out of this construction. It's not.
Well, there actually is such a parameter in, for example, you know, DenF's work. You know, it depends on.
DenF was not thinking about collodion. He was studying brains in fixed collodions. He wasn't studying, and none of the problems that DenF studied, at least any of the DenF papers that I read, were sort of rich enough.
No, this is his basic example of a split attractor, where depending on where you start out, you know, the object can be stable, or it can be a split attractor that attracts to a boundary of two objects, that's not state two objects that it would decay into in this other case.
Well, DenF was studying brains in collodions. He wasn't taking quiver gauge theories that from the start don't make any reference.
Well, he compared both things, but the work I'm talking about was just in terms of the attractor. So he was talking about this object using the attractor mechanism, and then you find this split attractor phenomenon and a transition depending on where you start in collodion moduli space. So presumably all that structure should be reflected if this is a dual description.
Mike, he was able to start from different points in collodion moduli space.
Right, and sometimes you
so
get
to he has control. I think that's what Andy's saying. He has control over what collodion he's putting the brain into, and he's looking at a specific collodion.
Well, there's probably some analog of his choice. If you can,
no, because it might be that Andy is implicitly putting himself close enough to the attractor point so that
it won't be a
split attractor.
The split attractor flows are the I think these split attractor flows. I mean, he has collodions in asymptotically flat space. And these radius of marginal stabilities always occur outside the near horizon region. And we're only looking at the near horizon region here. So he has an extra parameter, which is the modulus of the collodion at infinity. That's just not that's not in this problem.
It's a function of that. Maybe we should continue this later. So are there any other questions?
Okay. The individual has something in common with separation of variable in the main body system. So the Hilbert scheme, which appeared in new construction, can be considered as a phase space in embodied quantum mechanical problem. And this equation looks like a spectral curve in the corresponding...
This one?
Yeah, this one. Oh, it's better to write down for M B0 rates in that case. Does this, maybe this M body problem is just this quantum mechanical system you're working on?
Could be if it's the same equation, must be.